This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, a viral torture video has prompted renewed calls for UN investigations into human rights abuses in the Indonesian region of Papua. Fiji's Prime Minister distances himself from a controversial Chinese businessman, and American-grown kava. It's a new thing, and it's raising concerns in the Pacific. We'll have more on those stories coming up. We start in Papua New Guinea, where more than 1,000 homes were reportedly destroyed by a magnitude 7 earthquake. It occurred in the remote Sepik region, which is already affected by flooding. As Belinda Cora reports, authorities are still waiting for more details on the full impact of the disaster.
For weeks, there had been heavy rains and flooding along the Sepik River, but on Sunday, disaster struck when a magnitude 7.0 earthquake hit the area.
And all of a sudden, there was a earthquake yesterday, 7.0 magnitude. It's a big one. Then last time we experienced was the one that hit Chambri Lake was 6.0, but today it was 7.0 was a big one, but many houses have been fallen, while some was washed out by the flood.
Gideon Malo is a community volunteer helping affected families in Wasarogawi district and collecting vital information for a government assessment report. He's worried that many families are still struggling to move to higher grounds at this time.
Help themselves looking for ways to a safer place to allocate their property or move from the high flood area to the safest side, which is the land is high. So then they can be safe. But at this moment, it's a double disaster for them. So people are looking for help, trying to get some sort of assistance to evacuate them to the higher ground.
ACP Governor Alan Bird says more than 1,000 homes have been destroyed along with food gardens. Cyril Tara, a community leader from Kamanibit village, is worried food will soon run out.
So what I ask for the authorities from the province, all districts, to come down and have a check on the situation. And also we have no food, no rations. Water, it's very important, so immediately we need all this.
The Papua New Guinea government has announced 500 million kina in funding for natural disaster relief, which will also assist those affected in East Sepik. But in Wasarogawi district, Gideon Malo is worried government funds won't make it to the people most in need.
That's all I want from the government to do. I don't like people to use the disaster as their grounds to get things and then they don't look at those that have been affected. So these are some of the things that has been happened for the last earthquake, I think last year, April around. So this time I want those things to reach those affected people all the way from down Sepik and all the way up Sepik too.
Gideon Malo from Wasarogawi District, and the reporter there was Belinda Cora in Papua New Guinea. Pacific leaders are renewing the call for the United Nations to investigate human rights abuses in the Indonesian region of Papua. It follows a social media video of Indonesian soldiers allegedly torturing a Papuan man. As Kyle Evans reports, there's fears the video is just the tip of the iceberg of how the military's been operating in the region.
It was like something from the Dark Ages. A Papuan man sitting in a barrel of water, which slowly turned red as he was punched, kicked, and repeatedly cut with knives by Indonesian soldiers. Port Moresby's governor, Paus Parkop, was one of many horrified by the scene, but he wasn't surprised by it.
This is why we have been calling for the UN Human Rights Commission to do a proper investigation to hold Indonesia to account, because the military in West Papua operates with impunity. Jakarta hardly has any control over them. They do as they please, both in terms of dealing with the people, in terms of business. They've expanded into mining, into logging, into agriculture. You know, they virtually run the place. And so it's not surprised that this type of torture is taking place.
The incident has sparked fresh calls for the United Nations to intervene, after groups like the Pacific Islands Forum and the Melanesian Spearhead Group previously called for the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights to investigate. Governor Parkop, a longtime supporter of West Papuan independence, says he'll take up the matter with PNG Prime Minister James Marape in the hope of applying further pressure on Indonesia to welcome the inquiry.
Well, I will be raising this matter with him and with the government caucus. I raised it with the ministers in the government now. I know the Prime Minister is very strong on this PIF resolution. He was one of those who pushed for that resolution. So this is why I also want to have this discussion with him, so that when he goes to Jakarta for a state visit, he can raise this serious concern that we have about the human rights situation inside West Papua.
If an investigation fails to eventuate, Governor Parkop fears what the future could hold for West Papua under incoming Prime Minister and former military commander Prabowo Subianto.
Under his watch, so many atrocities were committed in Timor-Leste, in West Papua, in other parts of Indonesia like Aceh. During the transition to democracy in the 90s, so many political activists got disappeared. He's not been proven or found guilty of any of this offense, but it was under his watch. This is a concern that everybody should have within our region.
The commander of Indonesia's military in West Papua offered a rare apology for the incident, but alleged the victim was a member of a West Papuan armed rebel group and had plotted to burn down a health clinic. But Veronica Komen from Amnesty International says the victim was a civilian.
The human rights activists on the ground and I myself have spoken with the family members and then with the local tribal chiefs. They all have stated that these are civilians. In this case, the soldiers, as we know, they took this man and then tortured them. And then because they didn't succeed, then the army handed them over to police and then police took them to the hospital. So the act of releasing them means that both military and police at that time also admitted that they cannot find anything on them.
Ms. Komen says Amnesty International will campaign on behalf of the victim, while the Indonesian military carries out an investigation into the matter. But there's only so much they can do.
This is the problem always. When it involves soldiers, then cases will go to military court, will be closed from public, and then civil society like us cannot be part of it. Even if, if we do have evidence, we cannot give it to them.
Benny Wender, leader of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua, says a failure to launch a UN investigation will result in more trauma for his people.
Indonesia always reluctant and there is no evidence, there is no human rights violations. But today, the whole world can see it. Indonesia cannot hide it. So I hope the Indonesia allow it.
Benny Wender, leader of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua, ending that report from Kyle Evans. In Fiji, Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka has distanced himself from a Chinese businessman who has been placed on a priority watch list by Australia's intelligence agencies. Businessman and hotelier Zhao Fugang was the subject of a media investigation by Australia's Nine Network and the Organised Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. The Fiji citizen was accused of being a political operative for the Chinese Communist Party and of being involved in criminal activities. But Mr. Rambuka told the ABC's Lethe Movono he's unaware of the allegations.
As far as his alleged role as an operative of the Communist Party of China, I do not know. I do not have the facility nor the role to find out who is operating in the interest of which organizations in the world. I am Minister for Foreign Affairs and I deal with the embassy of the People's Republic of China. We have a very good relationship with the People's Republic of China.
Are you concerned at all over allegations that he is a person of interest in the intelligence community or in the criminal intelligence community of our neighbors? I appreciate that you've said that you don't have the capacity to address any such concerns or any suspicions which may happen. But can you tell us if you're personally worried that someone who is of interest elsewhere is operating in this country?
First of all, I believe he is a citizen of Fiji. So if there is an interest on a Fiji citizen from our neighbors, they will have to deal with it as that, as a citizen of Fiji. and apply the international protocols that apply.
What are those protocols, sir?
Well, there is a... we have the... what is the term that... When we have a person of interest who has been suspected of some criminal activities here, that we can ask a neighboring territory for them to be repatriated for legal processes. Whether we go to that extent or not depends on how seriously they look at this, and depending on the crimes they allege that he might have committed, are they crimes against their in their jurisdiction or international or what?
With regards to the agreement that your government reviewed early into your taking office, the Home Affairs Minister has since announced the reinstatement of that agreement to continue to have defense and security partnerships with China. What is your position with regards to that agreement? I'm sensing a difference between how you view it and how the Home Affairs Minister views it.
It was not disagreed. The agreement remains. We looked at the various aspects of it. One of them was that having officers from the Chinese police working here with our senior officers in the headquarters. That is not going. The agreement has remained in place, has remained intact. Aspects of it that we put into practice are changing all the time. And we have also written in a requirement that it be reviewed every 2 years.
So the Home Affairs Minister says that the agreement will be reviewed every 6 months, but there is a particular part of the agreement that which allows an exchange. There is some concern that the exchange of personnel could lead to things that have happened in the past to the previous government under the same agreement, where security officials, police officers and defense officials from the People's Republic of China were able to come into our territory and remove people that they allege were committing crimes back home and take them back without a fair trial in this jurisdiction. What is your position on that?
My position is that there has been no disagreement or misrepresentation of what should be going on, what has gone on. The agreement is still there. The execution of the various parts of it will depend on executive authority, and that is the Prime Minister and Cabinet.
What do you say to our neighbors who worry that scenes which are now coming to light several years later of Chinese officials coming into the country possibly repeating itself?
That is their concern. As far as we're concerned, we'll have to do our own due diligence on any movements of officers, high-ranking status in that jurisdiction, and whether it is of beneficial results for us in Fiji, and it's a matter of sovereignty.
Is there ever going to be a time you think in the future that there will be Chinese security or defense officials operating out of this country?
Out of here, no. In fact, working with their own embassy is something that is in the various agreements that deal with diplomatic relationships between countries.
And that was Fiji Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka speaking there to the ABC's reporter in Fiji, Lithe Mavono. And the lawyers for Mr. Fugang have told the ABC that their client vehemently denies the allegations. A group of American kava growers have produced their first locally grown crop with the hopes of serving the lucrative U.S. market on an industrial scale. But some in the Pacific are not happy, fearing the move will undercut their own product. And they've accused the Americans of appropriating the culturally important crop. Kyle Evans with more.
American-grown kava. It's a phrase you've probably never heard before. But over in the United States, A trio of kava entrepreneurs want to change that after growing their own unique mix of kava straight from American soil.
This started, you know, back in 2014 with the mission to see how far we can push kava as a plant. Is it only able to grow in the Pacific Islands? Can it grow other places? There's a lot of kava drinkers here in the U.S. It's 2024. We've got about 10 million kava drinkers. So that was kind of where it started. Let's see if we can actually grow this plant on mainland. And what we found was that kava is willing to adapt.
Tyler Blythe is a kava bar owner and distributor based in California. 3 years ago, he teamed up with Jeffrey Bowman and Matt Musifillo to create American Kava Culture, a group aimed at producing kava for the American market. Here's Jeffrey Bowman.
I've been importing and selling kava, distributing kava, and running a kava bar since 2002 every day of my life. Tyler and Matt and I all compete in the kava industry, but we're all friends. Tyler basically brought Matt and I on board when he got to a point with his kava growing research that he needed to try to see if the kava would grow here in Florida. He lives in California.
Turns out it does. The trio have produced batches of kava at both ends of the country using cultivars from Hawaii. They'll use it to supply their own bars first, with hopes of eventually expanding it to the 400 others across the US. For Matt, who is of Pacific American descent, the venture allows him to bring his culture full circle.
Whenever the people of the Pacific voyage to a new island or a new village or a new land, they always brought their agriculture with them. It's only in the last 100 years where there's been this disconnect where the people have stopped bringing their agriculture to grow. So we're really just coming full circle now with bringing kava to the people, because in America, there's more Tongans in America than there are in Tonga.
But not all growers are thrilled. Jonathan Naupa manages a kava business in Vanuatu. He grows and exports 24 tons of kava a year and is trying to crack the US market.
I just find it alarming from a local perspective. The vast majority of our farmers in Vanuatu are small lot subsistence farmers. You know, they grow kava to supply their communities for community ceremonies. They use it as a cash crop to pay for their children's education, their medical bills, their building materials when a cyclone comes along, you know, which is friggin' too often. And the kava plantings, they act as a tree bank or a shrub bank. You know, they're like they're sort of a family savings account for a rainy day. And the United States is like our major export market, you know. So any production in the United States, on the continental United States, you know, with the goal of capturing a share of the US market, it's gonna like just gonna smash us here, mate. If I were them, I'd be concentrating on setting up traceable pathways from Vanuatu to the end market in the United States and making that a beautiful story and everyone cutting the cake fairly. But no, they want the whole cake to themselves.
Pacific academics have taken issue as well, saying the US operation lays claim to an aspect of Pacific culture that isn't rightly theirs. Here's Sione Funaki, a doctoral student and anthropologist at the University of Hawaii.
Kava to us is not just a plant. It is an ancestor. It is an ancestral crop. We see ourselves being genealogically connected to this plant, right? Hawaiians cite it in their 2,000-line genealogical chant called the Kumulipo. Tongans claim genealogical claims to it as well, that it comes from a young girl and her family. It is a representation of the land, the people, our culture, our ancestors, and our descendants. When you take something as special and as important as that out of our realm, out of our areas, you know, you challenge our right and our indigenous right to continue to use that. You threaten the livelihoods of farmers, but also cultural practitioners now who depend on kava as a part of our daily rituals and routines. So I think that's kind of the main problem with it. By growing it outside of the Pacific, threatens the very foundations of our culture.
Fears have also been raised by scientist and kava expert Dr. Vincent Lebeau, who told the Fiji Times the variety of cultivar being promoted by the Americans, a variety known as Issa, was potentially dangerous and could threaten kava's reputation. But the Americans aren't concerned. They say the Issa variety is just one of many cultivars they own and has been diligently researched and lab tested to ensure consumer safety.
We're talking several thousand lab tests on different kava cultivars. And so, you know, there's ways of growing Issa. And when you take a cultivar from, say, Papua New Guinea, where it's very hot and the climate is different and the soil is different, and you plant it in a new environment, you see changes. the outputting product is much different than perhaps what Lebeau or some other scientists think of as ESA, because they've never grown it anywhere else.
That was Jeffrey Bowman of American Cover Culture, ending that report by Kyle Evans. To Vanuatu, where a government delegation is heading to the island of Santo to investigate claims against a Chinese logging company. The company has been accused of illegally cutting down trees, with photos of its workers dressed in Chinese military uniform sparking outrage last year. As Leah Lawanbu reports, the controversy surrounding the company is continuing to grow, along with the pressure for the government to act.
Vanuatu Forest Industry Limited was allowed to enter Santo and fell trees damaged 4 years ago by Tropical Cyclone Harold. But concern that the company was cutting down trees not affected by the cyclone sparked an uproar and the suspension of a forestry official. Timothy Tumokona, the Director General of the Ministry of Forestry, says a government team is heading to the island to investigate.
Yes, I can confirm that the Director of Forestry is currently suspended, and his suspension is linked to the logging operation that is happening on the island of Santo. We have received reports that there is a lot of trees that have been felled and are collected at couple of ports or anchorage in preparation for export. We have received those reports, but we have not got full information on the operation. I'm going down with another couple of senior officials to confirm those facts, and then we can advise the government on its next course of action.
Vanuatu Forest Limited, which is owned by a naturalized citizen of Vanuatu, has not responded to Pacific Beat's request for comments. But people on Santo say a large area of tree on the northeastern part of the island have been harvested since last year. Chief Watur Songi Malon Petel says they're still waiting for compensation for the trees.
The company has been resisted and got some agreements with the government. But with the custom owners, I think that's not a good idea, which is we've got the investors and the government doing agreement without the custom owners. About the process of the payment, I think it's better to certify that the custom owners or who was the partners from the registered investors, I think it's better to find it out whether they're probably the real custom owners or what. It's better to find out Where they're the right people. Like, I am also blaming the area where the logging was taking place out at Madanda's area. What we've heard about that the company handles the area to cut all where the cyclone has been blown down, I think that's not true. The logging has been made by all the trees that has been standing out in there, and also they've been damaged all the smaller trees out there as well.
Vatu Molisa, an environmentalist and liaison officer with the Santo Sunset Environment Network, says the government must take action.
All the livelihoods of our communities, especially rural communities living in Vanuatu, who depend about 80%, depend on these natural resources to give them food, water, shelter. And if these sort of practices continue, it's going to be very detrimental to our environment. And from an environmental standpoint, this is should be stopped. Authorities concerned should be stopping these practices. These companies that have been issued their licenses should be stopped and for themselves to be sent out.
The Director General of Forestry says they'll investigate the allegation and come down hard on the company if it has violated its agreement with the government.
Any possible course of action will also have to be in line with the Forestry Act and, of course, the requirements as outlined in the original agreement between the government and the company.
That was Timothy Temukon, Director General of Forestry. And the reporter there was Leah Lawanbu. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Mosuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific. And Pacific Review comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.